Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release of the declassified NSA surveillance documents that indicate the government went too far in collecting domestic phone data and misled the FISA court, prompting a rebuke of the NSA from a judge on the secret court that oversees the intelligence community's secrets. Cindy Cohn, the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which along with the ACLU sued to get the documents released, joins us. Then we will speak with Lynn Bartels, who is a journalist with the Denver Post who has been covering the recall elections in Colorado that resulted in the recall of two Democratic state senators who voted for tighter gun control laws after the massacres in Aurora, Colorado and Newtown, Connecticut. We will discuss the national political significance of this victory for the NRA, which was outspent 6-1 by pro-gun control opponents of the recall in spite of personal contributions of $350,000 by New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and $250,000 from Los Angeles philanthropist Eli Broad. Then finally, we will look into the chaos in Syria and the broader Middle East, and the historical legacy of colonialism, Zionism, and Western imperialism, with the author of a new book, Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Scott Anderson, a veteran war correspondent who has reported from Lebanon, Israel, Egypt, Northern Ireland, Chechnya, Sudan, Bosnia, and El Salvador, joins us to discuss the roots of the current turmoil in which he sees the Arab world continuing to be defined less by what it aspires to become and more by what it is opposed to. And joining us now is Cindy Cohn, who is the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel. She has testified before Congress and has twice been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal for her work protecting civil liberties online. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cindy Cohn.
Thank you.
The last time we spoke, Cindy, was when you filed a lawsuit on behalf of the Electronic Frontier Foundation against the National Security Agency in federal court in San Francisco. And it looks as if that lawsuit, which the ACLU joined, has borne fruit.
Well, we certainly have borne fruit in our Freedom of Information Act work, which was an earlier lawsuit. The lawsuit, I think, that we filed last time we spoke was about the attempt to try to stop the spying. The ACLU and the EFF had earlier lawsuits trying to get the government to release its legal opinions that the surveillance was legal, and the court opinions as well. And that's what bore fruit yesterday. So I know it's complicated. There's a lot of things going on. But the Freedom of Information Act work that we did is actually a couple years old. And finally, yesterday, the government coughed up a bunch of documents, although I don't think we're done yet.
And these relate to a time in 2009 when the NSA went too far in collecting phone data, domestic phone data, and then on top of that they misled the FISA court about what they were doing.
Exactly.
So I find it extraordinary that these rulings or these rebukes from the FISA court judges are themselves classified top secret.
Yes, I think it's a tragedy, really, because essentially what we have is a tremendous body of secret law, including, you know, secret court analysis about how the government has been systematically violating our rights with this collection. I think it's shameful.
So, first of all, there's an enormous paradox, or in fact an oxymoron here, that you have a secret court. That in itself is an oxymoron, because courts are supposed to be open to the public and testimony is supposed to be open. So that's the first piece of Orwellian logic, that you have a secret court. The second piece seems to be that there is no person who's an advocate for the American people or for the accused or for the defendants. It's all the prosecution. In other words, the only people who get to present evidence in this court are the government itself. So there's nobody there. There's no checks and balance. So the judges have to rely on government evidence alone. Isn't that the way it works?
That's correct. And the chief justice, the chief judge of the secret court right now, a judge named Reggie Walton in Washington, D.C., has even spoken publicly to the Washington Post about this, about how the court is essentially completely beholden to the government to do its own self-analysis and report to the court what it finds, and there's only one voice. And you can see in these decisions, in the filings that go back and forth between the government and the court, is that you know, the court really is at a huge disadvantage in trying to do some kind of oversight over this agency, because the only information it gets is from the agency itself, and it's all very carefully spun to present the government's actions in the best possible light. And they don't have any counterbalance there. And that's the basis for a lot of proposals to try to bring some reform here. You know, we understand that national security efforts of the government are going to have some amount of secrecy, but creating a significantly more transparency than what we have now, plus a more fair process, is on the minds of some congressmen, and we certainly think it's long overdue.
And one of the declassified documents is Judge Walton's rebuke to the NSA, where he basically saying that the privacy safeguards that the court has approved, the very guidelines that the NSA is supposed to operate under, quoting, have been so frequently and systematically violated that they never functioned effectively. And again, this is a judge that's hamstrung by the deck being stacked in the government's favor. And my understanding is that Chief Justice John Roberts has basically chosen almost all of these judges who've passed a very conservative judge's litmus test.
Well, the judges are picked by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. So before Roberts, it was Justice Rehnquist. So there's been a more conservative member of the judiciary hand picking all of the judges for a very long time now. I think that is problematic as well. When the FISA law was passed, it was an attempt to try to create some kind of rule of law over the government's national security spying. Remember, the FISA law was passed after the last time the national security apparatus of the United States was caught spying on innocent Americans. And it's clear that law has some flaws in it. It did create a basic rule of law over national security surveillance, but it plainly isn't the right fit now, and I'm not sure it ever was, for what needs to be done to make sure that, you know, there isn't a national security exception to the United States Constitution. Our rights don't have a national security exception. Some countries in the world do have national security exceptions to their constitutional rights, but ours does not. And it appears that this secret court with secret law, just hearing from the government, has created some form of a national security exception to our constitutional rights, and we need to fix that.
And again, I'm speaking with Cindy Cohn, who is the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel. She has testified before Congress and has twice been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal for her work protecting civil liberties online. So, in terms of the 14 documents that were just released by the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, on the DNI's website, what else is there apart from these letters of rebuke from this secret court to the NSA, basically saying, you know, you've overstepped your bounds, and this particularly refers to the collection of intelligence back in 2009, where only about 10% of the 17,800 phone numbers on this so-called alert list that they have for tracking foreign terrorists here in the United States met the tests and the guidelines that were laid down by this court.
Well, that's right, and it was discovered in 2009. Actually, it was admitted in 2009 by the government. But you know, it at the time, it's very clear from the papers that this had been going on for years, several years, before the government fessed up to the FISA court. Now, they claim that's when they discovered it, but you know, I'd like to learn a little more. I mean, the things that are still missing are pretty significant, like the court order from the FISA that originally authorized this kind of mass collection, right? This mass collection that government claims was authorized by the court. But we still do not have the judicial ruling that I think was issued in 2006 that authorized this in the first place. How did the court come to decide that they could do this mass collection in the first place? I mean, right now, we're all bogged down in the problems with the mass collection and how it really wasn't nearly as safe as the government admitted it to be. But let's go back to first principles. Actually, sorry, it was 2004. It looks like it was in May of 2004 that the FISA court first authorized this bulk surveillance. And, you know, we need to decide as a country whether we think bulk surveillance is okay. And simply dancing around the edges of when the government has actually misused the power and its own procedures, while that's important, you know, we need to step back a step and say, well, should the government have this at all? Is it constitutional for them to get it at all? And we do not have the court's ruling on that fundamental decision.
And much of this, of course, is what we've seen lately and what you've managed to extract from the government through the Freedom of Information on behalf of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Cindy Cohen has been provoked by Edward Snowden. I mean, there's no question that we wouldn't be having this debate but for him.
That's absolutely true. I mean, EFF has had litigation pending since 2006 involving the phone records program, involving the upstream collection of content. And we've been struggling in the courts because the government has maintained that everything is secret and has refused to basically participate in the litigation other than to claim that it's so secret it has to be dismissed. You know, the documents that Mr. Snowden has released have changed the conversation fundamentally because the government is now admitting what it's doing. Now, it's still defending them, but we're in a very different place than we were before the leaks, even for the information that we already knew. And frankly, most of what has come out so far isn't particularly new. It's that the scope of it and the fact that there are, you know, the government's own documents at issue here mean that the government can no longer pretend, you know, that these things aren't true.
But Cindy Cohen, we had that very close vote in the House recently, and that was essentially would have ended the legal device through which the FISA court has allowed the NSA to do this bulk collection, and that's an interpretation of the Patriot Act. And it gets down to the very question that's also in this release of documents, and these documents have just been declassified. The government talks about a reasonable, articulable suspicion. And the paradox or the inconsistency here is that how could you want to scoop up millions and millions of American citizens' phone calls in this big kind of mega data dump and then troll through it looking for reasonable articulable suspicion, and all this stuff gets stored. So it's essentially saying that every American is a suspect until otherwise disproven.
That's correct. I mean, I think this constitutes something called a general warrant, which you know, a warrant that basically provides only that a crime has been committed, and then lets the law enforcement just, you know, grab documents first and sort out second whether somebody did anything wrong or not. Is, you know, those kind of things are called general warrants or writs of assistance, and they were the basis for the American Revolution. The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution was written to prevent these kinds of things, very specifically general warrants and writs of assistance. It's in the history books. So I think it turns our constitutional system on its head. I think that, you know, when we think about the Fourth Amendment, we think about it as our right to be free of search and seizure, right? Well, the government's position is, well, the seizure doesn't matter anymore. They can seize everything, and the only thing that matters is the parameters of their searching. And we think that's inconsistent with the Constitution, and frankly, we think that's inconsistent with how people ought to be able to live in a free country.
So seize first and search later until the facility in Utah is finished, and then all of this, years and years of everybody's phone calls and texts and emails and Facebooks and God knows what else, we'll sort through that. And if you're okay, you're okay. But if you're not, or if you somehow name is confused, I mean, this is a government, by the way, that had a list at the airport after 9/11, which, of course, you know, we just have another anniversary of 9/11. That people like Senator Edward Kennedy would be held up and are not allowed on a plane because they're on a government list. So how can we have confidence that if they can't, you know, if they think a U.S. senator is a terrorist, they must think we're all terrorists?
Well, I don't think we should have confidence at all. And as the revelations come out, there's more and more indications of what you'd expect. I mean, you know, there are thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who are trying to do this mass surveillance, and you're going to have human beings are how human beings are. And so, you know, we've heard releases of many, many misuses of this information. You know, the NSA even has a term for it. It's called love int, you know, when they've got their analysts who are basically misusing this information in order to spy on their ex-spouses and potential girlfriends and things like that. We've seen misuses for all sorts of things, and we're just beginning to learn about it. So I don't think the American people should have confidence in this at all. I think we need to stop it and go back from scratch and reinstitute rule of law here, which means that the government first has to make a showing that you've done something wrong or that you're somehow affiliated with a terrorist or someone who they're watching with. And once they've made that showing, then they might get access to your communications and communications records. But they don't get to do that first, gather everything in first and only secondarily figure out whether you've done anything wrong, because that just leads to disaster.
But Cindy Cohn, the main revelation that Snowden made, at least the one that came out publicly first in the TV interview that he did in Hong Kong, that was the soundbite, was him saying, sitting at my terminal at Booz Allen Hamilton, which is a contractor for the NSA, sitting at my terminal, I could access the records of anybody, anybody's accountant, even the President of the United States, and I could basically download everything about this person, implying the full scope of searches, what I just referred to as emails, Facebook, phone, text, you name it. And that was so energetically refuted by people like the head of the NSA, General Alexander, and others. And the more we get this stuff dribbling out, the more it becomes apparent that this guy may be telling the truth.
I think, I mean, so far there hasn't been anything that Mr. Snowden has said that has not certainly in the whole, I'm not, you know, I haven't nitpicked through everything the man said, but his documents have all been demonstrated to be truthful documents. The most the government has been able to say is that maybe they're taken out of context in some situations. And, you know, on the other side of this, General Alexander has been revealed to be, I mean, there's no pretty way to say this, to be a liar. He lied to Congress about spying on Americans. They've been playing elaborate word games to try to mislead the American people. Some of them, I think, we're still uncovering. But they plainly aren't telling the truth and aren't being straight with the American people about all the way that they're spying on them. And there's a sharp contrast between, I think, you know, the information that Mr. Snowden's given us, which is largely checked out, and the, you know, shifting sands of defensive and misleading responses that we've gotten from the government. And it's not just General Alexander. I'm sad to report that, you know, President Obama's responses have been just as, I think, misleading to the American people.
So what's your sense then in terms of how much of this metadata they have and the nature of it? Because so far all the government's admitted to is that it uses AT&T and Verizon and these other companies, which they pay handsomely, to basically just collect the time and the phone numbers and the duration of the call, but not the people involved, and then only later will they go through and explore it based upon that notion that they have of reasonable, articulable suspicion. So it seems to me that at this point, as this stuff dribbles out, it seems that they collect an awful lot more than that, and that what Snowden talked about is the ability of just some junior guy sitting at a terminal. If they can check on their girlfriends and their ex-wives, can't they check on the President of the United States?
Well, I think so. And in fact, you know, after the revelations of yesterday, I'm not sure. So there are two different programs that are at issue, or not two different programs. There's two different statutes that the government uses to support what it does. One is the you know, what we call the associational tracking program, or the telephone records that it justifies under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. And what we learned yesterday is the idea that they're storing all this stuff and then just searching for it later and only when they've got reasonable articulable suspicion is not true. That's what they got busted for in 2009, which is they were using a very big 18,000 number alert list that did not include, only a small percentage, I think less than 10% of those were people who they had reasonable articular suspicion about, and that they were searching through the data as it went into the database every day for this much, much broader list. That didn't include reasonable articular suspicion. We don't know who was on that list, but certainly it wasn't what they had said to begin with. So their initial story about how this big storage of our telephone records database works just got blown a big hole in it yesterday by what they revealed, and this is what the FISA court is mad at them about. The FISA court said, well, you told us you were only going to do reasonable articular suspicion searches, and that's not even remotely what you've been doing for the last couple of years. So that doesn't appear to be true, certainly as of 2009 and several years before it. You know, how we're doing now, well, we'll have to wait until our FOIA request gets them to cough up what's going on now, but I certainly wouldn't trust what they're saying since it wasn't true before. And then the second program that they're doing is something that they're justifying under Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, and that involves content. Now, what they say they're doing there is that they're not really aiming at Americans. They're just accidentally or incidentally collecting the content of American communications on their way to targets that are legitimate targets. But that doesn't make a lot of sense either. We're learning that they went far broader than that assurances, and that does include the content of Americans' communications, and certainly they're collecting the content of Americans' communications. There's a program called the Upstream Program that's reflected in the slides that Mr. Snowden leaked and has been confirmed by some FISA court opinions that were released that demonstrates that they have real-time access to the fiber optic cables. They're making a copy of everything that travels over the fiber optic cables in our telecommunication systems. That's how your stuff travels over the Internet. The content and the metadata both travel over the same fiber optic cables, and we have documents and confirmation from the FISA court that they are basically making a copy of all of that stuff and getting a copy of all of that stuff. One copy goes to your destination, and the other copy goes to the NSA. So that's much, much broader than they'd have you believe. And, you know, we're still getting to the bottom of it. But, you know, it's not, you know, their initial responses and descriptions of how this stuff works are falling apart with each new revelation, and we're not done yet.
Well, Cindy Cohn, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Cindy Cohn, who's the legal director for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, as well as its general counsel. She has testified before Congress and has twice been named one of the 100 most influential lawyers in America by the National Law Journal for her work protecting civil liberties online. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a reporter from the Denver Post about the two Democratic senators who were recalled for their votes on gun control. You say that you're watching me on the telly, seeing me go nowhere. Your name is Big Brother. You say that you're tired of me protesting.